I am Plant Online. This is the commentary.ca. There's a new book out that's been released in time for the 200th anniversary of Simon Fraser's navigation of what is now the Fraser River, named for him. The journalist Stephen Hume's Simon Fraser in Search of Modern British Columbia is a very fine book based on a series of articles that have appeared in the Vancouver Sun, where Mr. Hume is a columnist, following the footsteps of Simon Fraser as he sought a more navigable route to the Western Sea for the Northwest Company. Hume envisions the journey that was had 200 years ago in this well-researched and wonderfully written book. It is not only an excellent view of how it was then, but an excellent book on someone we know but don't know nearly enough about. Stephen Hume, besides the Sun column, has written something like six other books and has won numerous prizes for his journalism. The book is from Harbor Publishing and retails for $36.95. I am pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Stephen Hume. Good morning, Mr. Hume.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Simon Fraser, he was prominent in the fur trade. He worked for the Northwest Company. What was his role there?
Well, he was at the time a partner in the Northwest Company. He has quite a colorful history. He began his career in the fur trade at the age of 15 in Montreal. He was he'd begun as a refugee from the American Revolution. He was born in 1776. He had the misfortune to be born right in the cradle of the Revolution and shortly before it began. So he was caught up in it almost immediately. And of course he also had the misfortune of having a father who was a loyalist who joined the British Army and fought with General John Burgoyne in the Northern Army that was marching down from Montreal attempting to reach New York City. His father was wounded in the subsequent battle, which took place not very far from where Simon Fraser was born, so he would have been a toddler at the time, just a little guy. And he was orphaned. His father died in prison of, I think the term that Fraser used himself was of ill use, which probably means that he was ill and his wounds weren't treated and he was probably starved and whatnot, as a lot were, and there was no Geneva Convention in those days, of course. So that was followed by a whole episode of what we would today call ethnic cleansing, in which the loyalists were driven from their land, persecuted until they left, and his mother and his siblings walked, we think they walked anyway, to Montreal, where he went to school. He left school when he was 15 and went to join the Northwest Company. The Northwest Company at the time was a commercial colossus. The fur trade was the single biggest commercial enterprise in North America at the time, and it was dominated by these two gigantic companies, the Northwest Company and the Hudson's Bay Company.
So he joined them at 15.
He joined at 15.
And he had a meteoric rise there, didn't he?
Well, I guess you'd say it was a meteoric rise. I mean, you wouldn't want to make too much of it, but because a partner was not a partner in the sense of being a majority shareholder or anything like that. A partner was somebody who had a piece of the company and was receiving a share of the profits each year. It was an incentive for people to do better in their trading capacity. But nevertheless, he must have been a pretty astute and commercially minded fellow in order to become a partner, because lots of these guys went into the fur trade and left the fur trade at just about the level they went in. At the age of 15, he was made a clerk, and he traveled to the west along the old fur trade routes, up the Ottawa River from the St. Lawrence, and then up the Mattawa River and across the Great Lakes, and then up the northern rivers into what they called the Northwest, which would be the northern part of Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and British Columbia and Alberta.
So this journey that was 200 years ago, he was 30 at the time?
Yeah.
And what compelled him to head out west?
Well, there were a number of issues at work. Of course, the fur trade had to expand in order to maintain the flow of furs. And there was a great incentive to find new fur trading territories. This was an incredibly lucrative business enterprise, even with the major costs. If I remember rightly, Alexander Mackenzie wrote that in the year 1798, one canoe load of furs coming out of the Athabasca district was sufficient to pay wages and salaries of every employee of the Northwest Company. That would be about 1,200 men for 1 year. And that year they took out 31 canoes.
Wow.
So you can see the volume of wealth that was being generated was pretty enormous. Now, there were very extensive costs offsetting this, and one of these costs was the fact that they had to move the furs from the northern part of Alberta all the way to Montreal. That was about a 4,000-kilometer journey by canoe. So extraordinarily expensive and time-consuming to move those furs by birch bark canoe to market for transshipment to Europe and China, which was where they were most in demand. Simon Fraser's job was to try and find a shorter route so that hopefully they could both expand west of the Rocky Mountains in order to grow their fur trading base, their resources, their resource base, their feedstock, I guess you'd call it, and also in order to cut down the transshipment distance. So really what was happening was a kind of economic rationalization, or a plan to have economic rationalization. So in 1805, Fraser was given instructions from head office in Montreal to cross the Rocky Mountains, find new fur trading territories, and also explore a navigable water route to the Pacific so that they could ship their furs from the northwest, the Athabasca district of Alberta and British Columbia and the Northwest Territories, and ship them down river, put them in sailboats wherever the river reached the sea, and then transship them directly either to China or around the Horn of Africa back to Europe.
Some of the descriptions that I've read of him in your book, he seems blunt, he seems tenacious. Well, what do you think drove him, other than, I guess, his job, of course?
Oh, I think he was primarily motivated by the commercial aspects of this. I mean, he was probably excited to be able to go on an exploring expedition like this. These were all young guys, and I think they would have been, it would have been quite an attractive proposition to them. On the other hand, I think his primary interest here was to grow the commercial base of his company, and that seems really clear to me from the fact that although he left with his instructions to find a way to the Pacific in 1805, which was at the same time that the Lewis and Clark expedition was marching across the American West in search of the mouth of the Columbia River, he took another 3 years to establish fur trading posts all across northern BC. His first post in the winter of 1805-1806 was at what's now known as McLeod Lake, about 130 kilometers north, slightly northeast of Prince George. Then he crossed over and built another one at Fort St. James, another one at Fort Fraser. Eventually they had forts on the Babine and at Fort George, which is now Prince George, and a couple of others down the Fraser River. But I think his primary motivation was commercial.
And just in establishing these trading posts, you write in the book that he is truly a seminal figure in our province's history, because if it weren't for him, I don't think... Well, I mean, how consequential is he, Stephen? Is he? I mean, if he weren't around, do you think...
I think he's much more consequential than has generally been accepted... I think there's a reason for this. I mean, I think there's I think to some extent the lack of interest in Fraser is motivated by class distinctions. Alexander Mackenzie is a much more literate writer than Fraser is. Fraser left school at 15. Mackenzie left early as well, but he's very well educated. He's very literate. Mackenzie clearly came in with a plan. The plan was try and do some exploration as quickly as possible, write his memoirs, and then leave the fur trade. And this is precisely what happens with Mackenzie. He's knighted. He becomes a member of the aristocracy. He gets an estate in Scotland and goes home. Fraser, on the other hand, is a pretty blunt kind of working class guy. He's not that well educated. He doesn't have the family connections that Mackenzie has. And so he tends to be overlooked. But what he did was create this infrastructure that was in place in the province for 50 years before the gold rush occurred in 1858. I find it interesting that we are celebrating right now the BC 150 celebration, which is all about the arrival of the Stampeders to the Fraser River gold fields in 1858. Nearly all of the growth of that expansion up the Fraser River relied to some extent upon the infrastructure that had been put in place by the fur trade 50 years before, when Fraser began establishing these forts in the north. There were forts at Kamloops, there was a fort at Yale, there was a fort at Langley, there was a fort at Victoria. What was in place was a system of communications and a series of transportation routes which used both rivers and overland trails that made it possible for all of these prospectors not only to find their way up into the interior, but also to resupply. They had safe havens if they ran into serious problems. And there was a whole body of relationships between these Europeans and the First Nations that had been established on pretty equitable terms during the early period of the fur trade. All that went by the board after the gold rush flooded up and established itself. You know, the first thing that happened when the fur trade, when the gold miners got into the Fraser Canyon, was that they started shooting First Nations people who were also mining on the bars. And we had the Fraser Canyon War, which Don Houck has written quite a good book about, McGowan's War, which I would recommend to anybody who wants to see the other side of this period that we're talking about. You know, my book really deals with the early incipient stages of the fur trade. Don's book really deals with the end of the fur trade.
Well, why do you think it is so that academia, I mean, you did mention that Mackenzie was more literate, but generally, why has academia neglected Fraser?
Well, there are a couple of reasons for it. I think for one thing, his records, there's been a dearth of records. His papers were largely dispersed. You know, we have copies of copies and things like that. Many of his papers were lost. Some of his journals are still missing. I know that there are a number of people, some in Vancouver and some on the eastern provinces, who are still searching for those missing documents to see what they might, what light they might shed on all of this. Whereas Mackenzie left a very clear documented record. I mean, he wrote it himself, so it was a bit self-selecting. But it made it much easier, I think, for academic historians to deal with him. And as I say, there was a kind of an instinctive preference for Mackenzie, particularly during the earlier period of our academic histories. This is my personal opinion, and then the other thing that happened was there was a major change in the universities starting about 30 years ago as people moved away from the idea of the importance of these, you know, the great man in history and the white European explorers and that sort of thing. There became a preference for
social history.
Social history, and for a look at things from the point of view and perspective of First Nations. And there's been a tendency, I think, for some political correctness to creep into this. I have talked to some people who want to portray Fraser as a kind of violent, exploitative force who came in to rob and wipe out First Nations, you know, displace them from the landscape. All that took place, but it took place actually 50 years later during the gold rush. There was certainly no incentive for fur traders to damage or dispossess the First Nations that they encountered, because they relied on them both for resupply and also for furs.
Right.
You know, if they got rid of First Nations, if they ethnically cleansed First Nations from their land, got rid of their trap lines, then they weren't having any furs come in. So there was no advantage to them to do this. And in fact, if you look at the early history of the fur trade, there's quite a bit of antipathy towards settlers who want to come in and settle on the landscape.
We'd read the start? I guess this was 4 years ago or so?
Yeah, it started way back in 2003 when I wrote a very brief memo to the editor of The Sun, Patricia Graham, suggesting that the first bicentennial was going to come up in 2005, winter 2005-2006, which would be the founding of Fort McLeod up on McLeod Lake, northeast of Prince George. And I thought this was something that was significant. Maybe we should do a story in advance and be prepared for it. And she said, go ahead and do it. And then the story just grew and grew and grew, and it became so interesting. And she was interested in it, and basically gave me a free rein to go and research the story wherever it took me. And so I was able to go to back east and find the place where he was born in the United States. I was surprised to discover that he was had been born an American, technically, although there was no United States at the time of his birth, no Mexico and no Canada either. And I became fascinated by the fact that the arc of his life really was the arc of the emergence of the modern North America that we know today. And the consequence of that, of course, was the title of the book, In Search of Modern British Columbia. I was looking for the foundations that were laid in this process that gave rise to what we know today.
You enjoyed going to all these places across the continent and across British Columbia?
Oh yeah, it was a great deal of fun. I mean, I enjoy getting out in the outdoors anyway, so for me it was not a great deal of hardship. I certainly don't mind being rained on now and again, or sleeping out in the open if I have to. And I like to canoe. Some legs of this journey, my daughter came along with me, and she's a very good paddler, and she was great company.
When you were going through the places that Fraser had gone through, obviously a lot has changed. Is there anything that's the same?
Well, the landscapes themselves remain the same. I mean, once you allow for things like habitation glows from big urban conglomerates and those sorts of things, the actual, what you might call the underlying bone structure of the landscape is still there. So when you're traveling on one of these great rivers, the Upper Fraser or the Churchill River system or what have you, it is very similar to what he would have seen and experienced. And so if you can put yourself in positions in the landscape where you know the individual was 200 years ago, and if you can figure out the precise time of day that he would have been there, you can experience pretty well what he experienced, and that's for me a really interesting way of connecting with the character, and trying to see things as he must have seen them. And I found this was possible right across the country. In some cases, he was quite precise about what time events occurred. For example, we know that he left the site at Fort George at precisely 5 a.m. on May the 28th, 1808. So it was easy for me to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and be on the side of the river. The only difficulty I had was figuring out precisely what part of the river he left from, but that was turned out to be not too difficult when we began looking at old maps and figuring out how the Nechaco River had wandered around and where the flooding sloughs were at the time that we were there. And then when I was able to get onto the river itself, I was able to do it at precisely the same day and roughly the same time of day that he had been on the river at a particular site, and that gave me a real sense of what it must have been like for him. Now, I was in a 750-horsepower jet boat, whereas he was in a birch bark canoe, and the river may have been higher or may have been lower by a few feet at any given time, but generally speaking, it was an interesting way to put myself in his shoes. And this was particularly true when we got down to the Vancouver area and we wanted to take a look at the place at Musqueam where he had a major confrontation with a band of Musqueam warriors, which must have been quite frightening. I know certainly some of his men attempted to mutiny afterwards. They were so frightened by the encounter. But we were able to go to the Hydrographic Service and have them tell us exactly when high tide was on July 2nd, 1808. And once we knew the time of high tide, we knew precisely what time he went into the Musqueam village, because you can only access that creek at high tide. That was a defensive measure that was practiced by many of the Stolo people on the lower river to protect their villages. They would go into sloughs that you could only access it for 20 minutes or so at high tide, and then the rest of the time they would be well back from the river and safe from maritime raiders. So once we found the precise time that high tide had occurred, we were able to take half an hour on either side of that, and we knew exactly when he'd been there and gone up the river. And then from there we were able to figure out precisely when he'd arrived at the Pacific Ocean. So simply by looking at changes in the landscape and going to roughly the same spot, we were able to stand right on the beach where he had seen the Pacific for the first time at precisely the right hour of day 200 years before.
You traveled the province in recent weeks about Fraser lecturing. What was that like, and what was the reaction from the people that came out to see you?
Oh, it was really quite remarkable. I was surprised at the kinds of turnouts that we got, even though we were really trying to compress this lecture series because we had a lot of territory to cover, about 800 kilometers we had to cover, 1,000 kilometers, I guess, and we had to get in multiple venues during the day just in order to make it work. And so I was quite surprised to find that people were coming out for noon lectures, and we'd get 50, 60 people out. We had a number of sellouts. I shouldn't say sellout, because they were free lectures. They were sponsored by two groups, the Vancouver Sun and an organization known as the New Pathways to Gold Society, which is an organization that's trying to encourage cultural tourism as a development for a lot of these interior communities that are facing downturns in the mining industry or in the forest industry or being blasted by the pine beetle infestation. Even in Vancouver, as I say, we got sellouts. We got sellouts in New Westminster. We had a lot of people showing up. We did one at Statham out by Mission. That was full. Now, in some places, we had small turnouts. There were a couple of places where we wound up going head-to-head with Game 5 in the Stanley Cup, and that was kind of tough.
You know, I was reading the book, and I forget now where you were, but it was where your mother-in-law was born.
Oh, Lachine, Quebec, yeah.
And Quebec. And you mentioned in there that your mother-in-law, she's no longer with us, she was quick with a witty riposte, as Henri Richard was with a puck.
Yep.
And I was reading that, and I wondered, what would she say, or something like that?
What would she say about what? About me?
What made you remember that? I mean.
Oh, I was just remembering that she was really great with one-liners, we used to be sitting around the dinner table, as everybody does, joking and whatnot, and she was just really fast off the mark with the repartee. When you said something you thought was pretty smart, I can't think of anything right now, nothing springs to mind, but she was pretty, she had a pretty sharp tongue, and she was really fast on her feet with it.
Yeah. What's next for you, Stephen?
Well, I don't know. I'm sort of decompressing from Simon Fraser. It's been 5 years of research and writing, and I'm kind of sitting back thinking what I might do next, but I really don't have any plans right now. I think I'm just going to take it easy for a while.
And you'll continue in the Sun?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I plan to continue in the Sun. I'm not at retirement age yet, so they won't be shoving me out the door for a few more years anyway.
One last thing before I let you go. I was just thinking, you said that you're decompressing from Fraser. You spent a number of years with him.
Yes.
Do you like him? Do you find that you find some affection towards him because you know him so well?
Oh, yeah, I think I would have got along fine with him. I think he was a pretty bluff kind of guy, blunt. I think he was pretty plain-spoken. I think he was he had a bit of a silver tongue. I think he could talk people into things. But I think he was a pretty earthy guy. I mean, I think his feet were firmly planted on the ground. and he was not, you know, he didn't consider himself a lofty intellectual. One of his kids said many years later that after he had completed his great journey, he was offered a knighthood, as Alexander Mackenzie had been offered a knighthood, but declined it.
Really? Well, Stephen, congratulations on this. It's a fascinating book, and I enjoyed reading it, and I think you've done a great service to all of us.
Well, thanks, and I appreciate the chance to talk about it.
The book is called Simon Fraser in Search of Modern British Columbia, $36.95 from Harbor Publishing. You can read Stephen Hume in the Vancouver Sun. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.